Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. The Gospel of Mark records, quote, "Jesus declared all foods clean," unquote. Why then should believers in Messiah Yeshua, Christ Jesus, consider the food laws of Leviticus? We look at Solomon's temple dedication, Leviticus's spectrum between holy and common, and Messiah's teaching that true defilement flows from the heart, not unwashed hands. Learn why the food laws and Peter's vision of pigs in a blanket are really about God's calling and cleansing of the nations, and discerning when He is at work in the hearts of humanity.
We're in lots of conversations about Mark chapter 7 here, about declaring all foods clean, which... that's one of the actual things we're going to be talking about here today, is what is actually being declared clean and what is the difference between clean and unclean. So one of the things that we're taking a look at here in this particular passage that we're looking at in Leviticus chapters 9 through 11 and the companion passage we saw there in 1 Kings chapter 8 and then, of course, Mark chapter 7. One of the things we'll start off with was that great prayer that we read about that King Solomon was praying right at the dedication of the temple. And what you might say, we're looking forward here in just a couple of months of celebrating the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence for this particular nation. And in a sense, what you see there in 1 Kings chapter 8 is a declaration of dependence. Is where you see Solomon is giving the marching orders for what the temple is all about. And by extrapolation, you could take it back to what the tabernacle was all about. And you saw a number of, case studies or situations that Solomon brings up in his prayer about different situations that the hearts of the people get into or the hearts of various visitors get into. So you see, like in 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 59 through 61, you see where it says, "And may these words of mine, with which I have made supplication before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God day and night." Yeah, day and night, "that he may maintain the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel, as each day requires, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God, there is no one else. Let your hearts, therefore, be wholly devoted to the Lord our God, to walk in his statutes and keep his commandments, as at this day." So when you're saying, "as at this day," we read there in 1 Kings chapter 8, the people were extremely excited. I mean, they were so excited about the dedication of this temple because, you know, it's moved from now a tent where it was in Shiloh, and then it was not a tent, and he had various furniture staying in someone's house for a long period of time where there was no tabernacle, there was no temple. It was the Ark of the Covenant was in someone's house, and his house was blessed by it being there, but there was no place. So people were really excited about this, and you see that they were celebrating having the Feast of Tabernacles and celebrating this dedication, and they were so excited. They not only celebrated for the 7-8 days for the Feast of Tabernacles, but it went into double the amount of time. And you saw the amount of offerings that they were bringing, a huge number. So when we see there in the Torah, when it talks about, hey, this is what you do when you dedicate the tabernacle, well, Solomon supersized it and quadruple-sized it. It was huge number of offerings that were given. And it harkens back, you might think, to that time of where you saw people were giving so many gifts for the building of the first tabernacle that eventually Moshe had to say, stop giving so many gifts, because the people were so excited about this. Because why? What had happened right before that giving of all the gifts for the tabernacle? The golden calf. and the big judgment that came after the golden calf and the big slap in the face and wake-up call for the people saying, oh, we have really gone off the rails here, but the Lord had mercy upon the people and then was going to be traveling along with the people because of the entreaty that Moshe had given for the people going so far off the path in the process. So people were ecstatic about the fact that the Lord was having mercy upon Israel and that the Lord was going to be dwelling in the midst of the people through this tabernacle. So thus, the outpouring of their joy. And here you have with the temple a similar thing. That's, this is not just going to be doing the tabernacle again, setting up the tent again, but no, this is going to be a grand building, an expression of, wow, we're just so happy to have the Lord's presence here with power again. Larry has a comment or a question over here.
Talking about Solomon.
Yes, Solomon.
You were?
Yeah, about the dedication of the temple.
Well, he came down quite a few slots in my estimation. Lately, I saw a video about him, and he built some of those altars to Molech, and you know he had to know what they used them for.
Yep, there was Solomon BT and AT, before the temple and after the temple. In the early part of Solomon's life, where he was praying for wisdom and being granted great wisdom, so much that it was attracting attention internationally, etc., and the blessings of God, and then the building of the temple. But then you started seeing the slide that started happening with the multiplying of the wives, and exactly what the Torah said would happen if he was multiplying wives. Yeah, that indeed did happen. So, yes, indeed. So, yeah, there is a time that before the temple, early life, and then there's the later life of Solomon. And they're almost like two different people, but in a sense, it's a good picture of how we can all go. We can be excited, really on fire for God earlier on in life, but either we get distracted by way too many things, pulled away, dragged away, and enticed. And then you can very much slide downhill with that. So that's where you get people thinking, whether you have the book of the book of Ecclesiastes or Kohelet, whether that was written by Solomon or not, that's up for debate. But that's one of the things that people hope for, that because it ends with this statement after it goes through the whole long-winded over many chapters in Ecclesiastes of I tried this and I tried that and nothing made me happy. Everything was havel, wind, the vanity. Everything was vanity. I tried this, I tried that. And then finally, the sum of all things, you know, you had some scholars that think it's just kind of a throwaway line that someone threw in a book just to keep people from jumping off a bridge after they read it. But rather it says, no, the whole sum of things is to do what? To keep the commandments. That's where the book ends. And that's where people think that perhaps you had Solomon after he slid so far down that later on in his life, he looked back on his life and where he started out and what he was praying about in his early days and realized, oh, wow, it was really all just havel. It was just wind, vanity, what a waste. So, you know, most people do face that kind of a crisis later on in life and going, have I just thrown my entire life away, going after this, going after that, wasted so much time. So, when we see this part of his prayer there in 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 59 through 61, where he's saying, the cause of his people Israel. And what is the cause of his people Israel? That all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God and that there is no one else. So when you say, what are the marching orders? You could say the Declaration of Independence, where in this country we spell out some of the founding principles of this country that ended up getting written into the Constitution as it gets framed out in more detail, you know, a decade or two later. you see what the original marching orders or the idea of where Israel was to go and what the temple was really all about, what the tabernacle is all about. And in a very similar sense, you see what the whole nation is about, because it's not just about what goes on in the building, because the building there, the temple, or whether it's a tent, it is a place for where the Holy One of Israel is putting his name and his presence there in that particular place. But even as you see in this prayer, you see Solomon saying, how can I even build a house that can contain you? How is that even possible? It's not. It's not possible to build a house that can contain the creator of everything. So thus, what are you doing? You are building a house where the Holy One chooses to be, and he chooses to put his name there. And the question is, why did he choose to put his name there? For what purpose? And this is part of what it is this, so that all peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God, that this would be a magnet for all nations, that this would be a focal point for all nations today. And when you see, here we are again today, everybody is talking about a small piece of real estate. Even up to this day, thousands of years later, they're talking about a piece of real estate. Now, even if we can go back and forth as to whether the modern state of Israel has gone off the rails or was ever on the rails or whatever, the only reason why there is any there is because the Holy One of Israel decided to put his name there, and this to be a magnet for all nations. And even it is there to this day. You know, all of us, we are descendants of those who heard about or either came from the nation that the Lord planted and heard about it because of the people that were called by his name, decided to preserve these words and faithfully pass them on from one generation to the next, from one generation to the next. So, like with this country here, 250 years later, do we still hold these truths to be self-evident? Like it says there in the Declaration of Independence, do you still hold these things? And you could say largely no. That's a lot of people would quibble by endowed by your creator and all those elements like that. So in a very similar sense, that with the founding of the temple, do we still hold those truths to be self-evident that Solomon was praying about with the temple? Yes, Larry, you've got a comment or a question there.
But it says he is able to make good even come out of evil.
He's able to make good come out of evil. And he's the potter that's shaping the clay. And he can make it into one form or another for honor or for dishonor. And so thus, that's kind of what you see the Solomon praying about is like, oh, yeah, the temple and the people that are surrounding it, this nation, they can go off the rails and lose sight of why the Lord started it. And then you could see the Lord is just not going to be with them. And they will fall victim and then be sent into exile. And then you see also the praying for the reboot, that if we are ever hauled away out of the land, that you would then, just like you told Moshe there, talked about in Deuteronomy, that if we fall away, that you would call us back, bring us back, revive us again to get back to this cause of Israel, that is to have all the world, all the peoples of the earth know that the Lord is God and that there is none other. To be wholly devoted to him, not, and that was it, when you talk about Solomon going off the rails, wholly devoted to the Lord your God, there was a problem that Solomon had later on in his life. He got, his heart was divided between not just the God of Israel, but a whole lot of other gods that came in with the various wives that he brought into his kingdom. Now, another part, a really key part of this, and we referred to this yesterday on Shavuot when we were talking as a hint about this particular passage and talking about how this call to all nations is just like we had read previously, this was a part of what the mission of Israel was. And then also the temple as the focal point of the nation. It is to be a beacon for all the nations to not just show off, hey, we got nice stuff and we got a great architect and we got a great interior decorator and wow, we've got a great staging crew. They've got it all tricked out and it looks nice. No, it is about who dwells there. Who dwells there, and then what that does to the people inside. Not outside, inside. What it does to the people inside. So you see in this, further up in this prayer, there in 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 41 through 43, it says, also concerning the foreigner who is not your people Israel, when he comes from a far country for your name's sake, for they will hear of your great name and your mighty hand and of your outstretched arm. When he comes and he prays towards this house, hear in heaven your dwelling place, and do according to all for which the foreigner calls to you, in order that all the peoples of the earth may know your name, to fear you, and as do your people Israel, that they may know that this house, which I have built, is called by your name. And called by your name, you know, just similar to what we saw when we were going through the Ten Commandments yesterday on Shavuot, is when you saw about taking the Lord's name in vain or treating it with making it less, making it common, which is actually similar to what we're talking about here today about clean and unclean. When you make it common, nothing special, that reputation of the Lord is not anything that people are drawn from all over the world to. Because why? They've got their own so-called regional deities. If the creator of heaven and earth, the Holy One of Israel, is no different than any of the others, why would anybody care? They've got their own so-called deities. So why would they make a trek, a pilgrimage to go somewhere else? They've got their own. You know, they probably got bigger and more tricked out temples where they're at. Why would they want to go somewhere else? So that is one of the risks about if you make the name of the Lord lower, of make it common, make it of nothing. That reputation of the Lord is nothing special. And that is one of the devastating things that you can do to the whole world, is to make the reputation of the Lord nothing special, that no one cares. So one of the things that you look at when it says here, and concerning the foreigner, the word that's used in this particular place, we've mentioned before the some various Hebrew words that are used for foreigner. The one that you'll commonly see is ger. Another one that we see in this particular place is nochri. Now, nochri is used, translated in various ways. The theological word book of the Old Testament talks about the root verb of that, nachar, carries several different meanings, one of which is to inspect or to look over. So when it's talking about a nochri, that's why you're not talking about someone who has no connection to what you're doing. The nochri is somebody who is worth taking a closer look at and inspecting. Because why? In other uses, it goes into where these are prized possessions that you may want to closer inspect, is where this word is also used in other places. So these are not just people that are passing through and, you know, happen to be stopping to take a selfie there at the temple. These are people who the Lord wants to inspect further. And because the Lord is taking notice of them, so then the people who are called by the name of the Lord should also take notice of them. So thus, when you start seeing these commands in the Torah and throughout the prophets to not oppress what? The widow, the orphan, and the ger, or the nochri, those who are being called by God, you do not want to oppress them, to drive them away, to drive them down. Why? Because that's the whole point of what Israel is to be a beacon for all nations, to call all the world in. So if the Lord is busy calling people in, and the people called by his name are busy trying to drive them away or block them from approaching, you've got a huge problem. Yeah, you've got a huge problem. You're trying to block away and block those who are trying to approach. Anne has got a question or a comment over here.
So you say the Lord is looking at the Nochri, the person that is special to the Lord, to look at him. What about the Nochri seeking the Lord or seeking for something? He's looking, the seekers, because it says, seek for me with all your heart.
Yeah, so these are the people who are called, and they're coming close. So when you see the prayer earlier, that they have heard about the name, they're heard about the reputation of the Lord, and they're attracted, they're drawn to the Lord. And like what you see later on in the prophets there, in Zechariah talks about there in the day of the Lord, there will become a crisis of meaning, and people will be at a loss to know what to do. And they'll grab on to the tzitzitot, to the fringes of those who are called by the name of the Lord, and say, hey, we've heard God's with you. And the implication of that is, we need him. We need him. We've heard that you know who he is. So we need him. So we help us. We're trying to draw near. So thus, that's an impetus to the people of God. Be ready when that happens, when people are being called out and they're desperate and they're just grabbing out and say, hey, we hear that you're called by, we heard that you know who the Creator is, the Holy One of Israel. We heard that you know who he is. So tell us about him. Tell us about him. So yeah, that's what we're here. So exactly. So when we take a look at the really big ideas that we get out of these particular passages, whether we're talking about back in Leviticus or the passage we're looking at there in 1 Kings, or when we're getting over to Mark chapter 7, that we remember that what makes one fit to approach or unfit is what the issue is. Because we'll be looking at here that there's like a spectrum that goes between, you could say, holy, kadosh, on one end, set aside, and as we'll see in a moment, the other side of the spectrum is chol. And chol is what you'd say common. So between kadosh and chol, and that's where the spectrum goes. And then we'll see as it comes in further, then you've got tahor, which is fit to approach, or call it clean is how it's commonly translated, and tameh, which is commonly translated unclean or unfit to approach. So you got the spectrum between kadosh, holy, chol, common or profane is another way that's translated. And then moving inward from that, you've got tahor, fit to approach, tameh, unfit to approach, clean, unclean. So one of these things that we see when we go through the Torah, and we always have to be reminded, is that a lot of what the inner parts there, we talked about kadosh and chol. So holy and profane as spectrums there. But the differences between tahor and tameh, or clean and unclean, you can sometimes have not a lot of control over that. For example, men, as you see in the Torah, there are some things that will shove you over into the tameh or the unclean things. Certain times, things happen. And then women, same thing. You can move from tahor over to tameh, from clean to unclean, just with cycles of life. So that's why when you see that, it's not the ends of the spectrum. The ends of the spectrum being the kadosh, or set aside for the Lord, and chol, or profane, common, no different than anybody else in all the nations. So one of the things that you see between the difference when you get into that narrower distinctions between the tahor, or clean, and the tameh, or unclean, is that's where you start seeing with Leviticus chapter 11, where it starts talking about to make a distinction. And when you were doing that, you were with the things that you do have control over in your life, and the things it talks about in Leviticus chapter 11, like food, but largely you do have a lot of control over that, about food. So thus, with when you're saying the things that are in the fit versus unfit, you're saying with the food that you are, in a sense, fasting, choosing to not eat the things that are on the tamei, or the unclean, the unfit to approach things that get associated with that. So it is a lifelong choice to say, okay, I'm avoiding this whole tamei, the unclean section of foods in that. Why? It's about the lesson that this is bringing. Just like what we went through all of the chapters there in the beginning part of Leviticus, chapters 1 and all the way through chapter 7, where it's talking about the different offerings and the different procedures that go with the offerings. And we talked about how that process there is really with the life of the person there, going as you start out with the olah offering, and then you start moving through with the sin and then the guilt offerings, and you're ending up at the end with the shalamim, or the peace offerings at the end of it. You've completed this journey across this and your approach toward God. So that's what the beginning parts of the book of Leviticus in that, and you get this picture, hey, pay attention to what's going on. And we saw that when we were going through in chapter 9 and chapter 10, chapter 10 especially, right after the whole issue with the two sons of Aaron that had the fiery judgment, you see that there was a distinction, that there should have been attention paid to what was going on there. And you see Moses saying, hey, you didn't follow these instructions. You were supposed to, as a part of what the whole lesson of these offerings is, and the priesthood was supposed to be eating up these sin offerings, a part of the lesson saying what God is doing with your sins, your transgressions, iniquities, that it's getting consumed. It's not because the priest is eating it that your sin goes away, the so-called sin eater. It is a lesson saying, that is what God is doing with your sins, your transgressions, your iniquities. Ultimately, he is consuming them up. And so when you get out the other end, your relationship is shalom, peace. You have reached contentment with heaven and earth. And that's why you see the Messiah say, hey, when you're getting to the point of the shalom, the peace offering, make sure that you've settled things with other people, not just with God, but with other people as well, so that there is peace between heaven and earth and yourself and other people there on earth. So we've seen with all of these offerings in the beginning part, hey, be meticulous, watch out, because there is a distinction between the world that is on the spectrum out towards the common, and the things that are on the other side of the spectrum towards the holy. The things that are in the whole, or the profane, the common, and then the other side is towards the kadosh. It looks like Anne has a comment or a question over there.
We know that the two brothers, the two sons of Aaron, were consumed by the Lord, but the two cousins or whoever they were, Mishael and another brethren, they weren't consumed. I mean, they went into the holy. Didn't they go into the holy place to take their bodies out?
Yeah, because that was their task, to basically be the pallbearers, you could say.
So that was an exception that Moses made.
That was the basically saying, okay, somebody needs to go in to remove them. So they are getting that special dispensation to go in and to remove that. So thus, when you see, like, just like we've gotten through with our journey going from Passover to Shavuot, this journey going on from Egypt, our house of bondage, up to the land or the house or the place of rest, that is a journey that all of humanity is going on. And that in between, to be, you could say, if you don't find the destination or you get off the path there and you could say jump off the path in between your house of bondage and the place of rest, you see one of the examples, the foretaste of Israel wandering around in the desert until that generation dies. So that is a way that leads to death, because if you don't go all the way into the land of rest, then that's destination, there is no other destination in between. There is going from your house of bondage, the things that you are enslaved of in the world, and then going to the house of rest, the place where God has removed your sins, your transgressions, your iniquities, forgotten them, purposely forgotten them, and remember them no more. And so you are then at peace and at rest. And that is the destination that all humanity is going on. And so thus you see the call is for everyone in the world who is getting called and lured and distracted on the journey between their house of bondage and the land of rest and freedom in the Messiah. That's heaven keeps calling all the people that are getting called and distracted off the path. Get back on the path. Look at the destination. And that's part of what we were seeing here with those Nochri, that those people who are being called by the Lord to come in, they may not even know what or why they're being called in, but they just hear this call that's getting in through all the noise in the world. Get in the boat. get in the boat. You know, and you see, like, examples that we get in just small glimpses of them throughout the Bible. And you see, like, with Cornelius, that's an example of one, of being called throughout all of the noise of the Greek world at that particular time period, to hear through all of that and to hear the voice of the Lord calling through all that. That is an amazing thing that the Lord is getting through in a picture for all of us here. So now you can get an understanding as to why it is there when you have at the Acts 15 conference that they're saying, hey, if the Spirit of God is calling people, don't get in the Spirit's way. Realize when the Spirit is working here, don't get in heaven's way on this. And so, yes, the destination as to where you're going is life. And that is the lesson that is throughout all of the tabernacle and the temple, is that destination, when those who are far off are being brought near, they are getting closer to the source of life and not being wandering around, lured after nothing that results in anything but just death. So, taking a little look under the hood, one of the things that you see it in Leviticus 10:10, which kind of sets up, because it's the talk there of setting a distinction between that which is holy and that which is profane, and that which is clean, and that which is unclean. You see that in Leviticus 10:10, where it says to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, and between the unclean and the clean. And under the hood there, the words that you have there in Hebrew, we've talked about them already, but if you just want to see them all there in one place, that's you have the offering, which is the word korban, you know, which is what you see also in the, you'll see it in the passage we looked at in Mark chapter 7. It mentions it in passing. That's, hey, something that I would have offered, I considered it to be korban, which it just came to be transliterated over into Greek. Hey, this is the word for your gift or your offering. But as we've seen going through Leviticus, it is the meaning of it on the underlying realm of where it says karav, it is to approach, to move toward. So thus, when you start having a picture then of kadosh, it is on the realm of holy, and then with kol on the other end, profane. Tahor, clean, and tameh, unclean. So again, that which is set apart for something on one end, that which is not set apart for heaven's purposes on the other end, that which is fit to approach, that which is not fit to approach. So that's a really important thing to get into your head when we start going back and looking through passages like we had mentioned it briefly yesterday about Acts chapter 10 and about the Peter's vision of the sheet, that the word there is koinos, which is the equivalent of chol or common, not your other words that are in between, not talking about clean, which is katharos, or unclean, where akatharos. These are on the extreme ends of this, kadosh and chol, or hagios and koinos on the other end. So that which is holy and that which is common. So that common thing is like we were talking about, of nothing special, of like all of the nations there. So then, when you start moving in closer, you start seeing that what you're talking about with tahor or clean, it is something that is not blocking you from approaching God's presence. Versus whether you're talking about tamei, that is unfit to approach. But it does not mean sinful, because that's on what the extremes are. Between kadosh, which we translate usually holy, and chol, or profane, those are the extremes of where you're talking about, oh, you're talking about to the realm of being sinful or perhaps wicked on the other end. So that's why it's very similar to when Yeshua is saying, hey, don't call someone you fool. Where, because you're now implying someone is all the way at the end of being considered whole or common, basically at being sifted around in the world by the adversary and all his minions. So don't ever relegate somebody out there to that, because you have no idea if they are actually what heaven would call a nochri or a ger, someone who God is calling closer to them. So don't start sending someone over to the extreme of saying, hey, they are forsaken of heaven on that. So with that, kind of shifting over to Mark chapter 7, and with all of that set up there and getting back to what is the actual punchline of Mark chapter 7. And thus, you know, you could think that many people will bring forward that Mark chapter 7, you know, thus he declared all foods clean is the punchline of that. However, the punchline of it, as we have seen many times when we go through parables and teachings, that oftentimes you will say the last lines of the parable are the most important ones. unless you see Yeshua specifically go through and explain in detail what each of the elements of a parable are and what you're to get out of them, most often than not, the punchline of a parable is the most important aspect of it. And so what is the punchline? And that is in verses 15 and then 20 and 23, where it says, you know, there is nothing outside of the man which can defile him if it goes into him. But the things which proceed out of the man are what defile the man. And you see, when we read through the whole chapter of Mark 7, you see some other healings that happen after that. And especially the one thing about the guy who had that oppressing spirit that kept him not able to speak. Now, that's a very interesting connection, because you could say it's a miracle that is connected to this very thing that Yeshua is talking about here. It's what was it that was blocking him from speaking? And what was the point that Yeshua was making earlier with it's not which is outside of the man, but it's what comes out of the man? Because the tradition that's being talked about here, and they mention with the washing vessels in there, is that if the tradition of the time period is that being in the marketplace will contaminate you just by being out in amongst the hoi polloi, so to speak, will be that which contaminates you, just being out in the marketplace. So thus, when you come out to the marketplace, you come home, you must wash off the marketplace. You must wash off that contact that you've had with the outside world. And thus, then you can eat something that is clean in and of itself. Because when you're talking about your lifelong fast of everything that is tamei, unclean, what you're eating is everything that is tahor, or clean. But because of this tradition that was on top of it saying, no, it will be unclean if you have your unclean hands that you've got when you're out in the marketplace. And if you touch that, then you make that unclean. Well, Paul makes a similar point when he says, hey, don't call what God calls clean unclean. So the tradition was saying, hey, God says these things are tahor, they are clean. But if you're out there in the marketplace and you don't wash your hands before you touch it, then it becomes unclean. It becomes tamei. Well, the problem is you go to Leviticus 11, you don't see that. There's no pitcher clause in there, the washing clause in there, that it will make it unclean if you don't wash before you eat it. So thus, that's why you were seeing this chastisement where Yeshua is saying, hey, you are setting aside the commandments of God with these traditions of men, saying, hey, these things are becoming tamei, unclean, just because I didn't wash my hands from the marketplace when I came in here. What is most important? And what is the whole thing of tahor and tamei supposed to communicate? Well, we read it. It's the punchline of chapter 11 is right at the end of it, just like you see here. It is to make a distinction between the things that are kadosh and chol, holy and profane and common, and the things that are tahor, fit to approach the presence, and tamei, not fit to approach the presence. That is what the whole point of Leviticus 11 and all the food instructions are. It is to say, hey, pay attention to those things which are coming into you. Pay attention to it. Pay attention to it, because you can get off course, like Solomon. If you're not paying attention to those things that he was taking into his life with the practices of the foreign wives that he was bringing in, and then participating in their high places worship to various deities, he wasn't paying attention to that. He wasn't paying attention to these things that, was it the very few rules that the Torah has for a king, and he broke all of them? So it's like, it's a short list. And yeah, not paying attention to those things which you should be paying attention to. That is what the lesson of tahor and tamei, clean and unclean, is. watch out for those things that you are yourself are doing, or just the things around you that can cause a problem in your approaching the presence of God. And if those things happen, you have to go through a, you could say, a detox process, just basically saying, pay attention and see that, just like what Leviticus 10 says, you just can't waltz into the presence of God anytime you want, even if you are one of the priesthood. You have to have an invitation to go in. And then we see in Leviticus 16, it talks about, yeah, when that invitation to go into the Kadosh, the Kadashim, or the Holy of Holies, when that comes, that's once a year. But even to go into the holy place, that's, you know, you have to go through a process to go in. The priests then have to wash their feet, and as they go in to the holy place, they just can't waltz in anytime or however they feel like it. So one of the things that when you start now talking about the punchline is where Yeshua is saying in Mark 7:15 that nothing outside of the man which can defile him if it goes into him, but the things which proceed out of the man are what defile him. And then, you know, going on in verses 20 through 23, where it says, that which proceeds out of the man, that is what defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed the evil thoughts, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting and wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. All these evil things proceed from within and defile the man. So if your life, your thoughts are obsessed with this list here, that's an indication there is some internal problems going on there, that you need a cleansing from the inside. If your life is obsessed with this kind of thought life and that spills over into your actual life, that's telling you you've got a problem. Where Paul talks about the fruits of the spirit versus the fruits of the flesh. These are the fruits of the flesh category here. And they're saying, okay, these are the fruits of the flesh, which are coming from what? Your internal, your heart condition is that of the flesh. You have a heart of flesh that needs to get changed here. Yeah, like an oil change, yes. And a heart transplant, yes. So thus, when you're talking about these instructions, it's a lesson in internal purity, whether, and that is what the buildup to this, you know, thus, or it goes into his mouth and then into the latrine, using the literal terms that are in there, purging all food, or catharsis all food. It goes into your body and out. And thus, if there was any sort of contamination from the outside that was there, what happens to it? Yeah, it goes through your digestive tract and out the other side. So if you're thinking you're getting some contamination from the outside world in there, and you think that's, you know, washing your hands is going to have some sort of a change in the situation, well, what is it really going? Yeah, it's just going through your digestive tract here. What is the outside that is not corrupting? Yeah, this is not a lesson in public hygiene here. This is a lesson in spiritual hygiene. What is the actual corrupting influence? Now, you should always be careful, because what's you are surrounding yourself with can seep into you if you do not do what? Like we talked about yesterday, take every thought captive and bring it into subjection to the law of Messiah. You've got to have that filter going on there. And that filter is the words of God, the Spirit of God working together to be that filter. So just like we were talking about with Cain, hey, sin's crouching at your door. You don't let it in. Because why? You know what happens when you do that. You don't want to go there anymore. You talk about the guest that doesn't leave. Yeah, you let that guest in. It's going to be a problem. And you see that the parable that Yeshua tells about then having to throw that guest out. And if you don't change the situation, it can bring a lot more guests to come over and occupy your house. And the situation then becomes worse than when it started. So I hope that's then a helpful thing to take a look at with this, to see, yes, you're talking about a situation where the focus was, now, like we've mentioned in times past, these traditions that have come along are helpful if you keep them in perspective. You keep them in perspective of what they are doing. That you are saying, okay, this is a practice that is, you know, perhaps helping me to get closer to God. But if you are having your traditions that are getting in the ways of the things of God or reinterpreting the words of God, then you're starting to have some serious problems where a tradition is now changing the words of God to say something else. And then when you start getting these traditions that are then blocking the people that God is calling into the kingdom, where you see a practice that's laudable in one sense of saying, hey, be careful about associating with Gentiles or people of the nations. Okay, for people that had huge problems with syncretism and idolatry and letting that seep into your practice of God, you could say that's a laudable tradition. But what did it lead to? It led to then not being able to distinguish who was God had made kadosh and who was over on the whole or the common profane side, and not being able to discern the difference of what God was doing. And that was the point of Peter's vision that he then keeps repeating to various assemblies and councils in the chapters after Acts chapter 10. He was repeating it again in chapter 11 and 12. And then finally, you see it reach a crescendo there in chapter 15 at the Jerusalem Council of making this determination, hey, when the Spirit is calling people in, you need to discern when God is working. And we mentioned it yesterday about Gamaliel is able to discern, hey, God is working here. I don't quite understand what's going on here, but you've got to admit God is working. So I don't want to get in the way of saying God is not working or attribute that to the adversary saying, hey, no, the adversary is actually at work here. No, that's heaven forbid that you would do that. So with that, that's kind of where I want to take things today. I hope that really kind of ties together what we were talking about yesterday with this mission that's going out to the nations and calling all the nations in, and that this call that's going out to all the nations, then to realize what is actually at those extremes, that what God is moving, setting apart for the kingdom, making them kadosh, versus who is still out on the other extreme of chol or profane or common, and realizing when God is moving them from one side to the other. Like we were talking about with Solomon, also watching yourself when you're moving from the kadosh side over towards the chol or the common, and when your life is starting to go in that direction. And thus, those wake-up calls, those reality checks of fruits of the Spirit versus the fruits of the flesh are those, you know, blinking warning signs of saying, oh, okay, you know, on this path headed from our Egypt to the promised land, we're wandering off in the desert here somewhere. Time to call for help. Get the Tammy's got a comment or a question over there.
Yeah, I guess maybe one quote that could be a good conclusion is Clement of Alexandria said, "The all-wise educator, by the lips of Moses, compared association with corrupt men to living with swine when he forbade the ancient people for partaking in swine. He made it plain in those words that those who invoke God should not seek the company of the unclean, who like swine revel in bodily pleasures and filthy habits of life and impure delights, itching for evil-minded pleasures." So you think about how the Jews wrote off anybody as a Gentile. They wrote them all off as being people who were just interested in bodily pleasures and filthy habits of life, as maybe Clement would say. But God giving that vision to Peter, and then when the events played out and you could see the Holy Spirit coming down on those Gentiles, you know, everyone there could see that the issue of clean and unclean is not DNA.
Not DNA.
You know, your ethnic profile from ancestry.com. The issue is, are you seeking after God like Cornelius was, or are you seeking after the flesh and the evil things of life like many of the Sadducees were? So that is how we should discern those who we would maybe put into our lives because they need to hear the gospel versus those people we bring into our lives because we need friends and confidants and people to strengthen us in the faith. That's what we should be seeking after.
Yeah. Amen. Yes, Anne, go ahead, please.
It's really interesting when Mary Magdalene or one of the women came to Jesus and the Pharisees said, "Why do you associate with adulterers and publicans and tax collectors?" You know, and we see the outward appearance of even our homeless people, and it, you know, we say, "Oh." I mean, we can in our hearts say, "Oh, I'm glad I'm not like him." But, you know, we need to examine ourselves and say, we don't know. It could be one of God's own choice people, like Mary. She was at the tomb. She saw him first. I mean, I was like, we got to consider that we don't know where they are in their search for the truth. So don't judge them or push them aside in your thinking. And I have to think about that myself when I see these teenagers and these young people going and becoming very anti-Semitic and that. I don't know whether God is going to turn them around or not. They could be like St. Paul, you know, fall on the ground and go blind for a period of time. Who knows? They're already blind spiritually. So I think all of us need to. I know myself, I need to re-examine my own heart about judging others because of their outward appearances and their circumstances.
Yeah, so you know, should always be praying that for those that are oppressing us and such, you pray for them that the Lord would speak to their hearts, turn them around, and get them going in a different direction. So we can talk about the Messiah saying, "Hey, pray for your enemies." That change of heart to turn them around, because they could be some of the greatest greatest witnesses for the kingdom. I mean, you see the testimonies of some that used to be the members of Hamas. The Lord turned them around, and wow, they are just on fire for the Lord. So you know, you just never know where someone's going to grab somebody and turn them around.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.